Armenia's prime minister says there could be an exodus from Nagorno-Karabakh.
A mass exodus could change the delicate balance of power in the South Caucasus region, a patchwork of ethnicities crisscrossed with oil and gas pipelines.
Plus, the U.S. government is less than 1 week away from a shutdown if the Republican-controlled House of Representatives can't pass key legislation.
We certainly have time yet to go, but he's in a very difficult position because the holdouts keep saying to Kevin McCarthy, don't bring bipartisan bills to the floor.
And how Russian elections coming up in 2024 may impact the global community. Today is Monday, September 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. Armenia's Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, said on Sunday that the likelihood was rising that ethnic Armenians would flee the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Reuters' Edward Baran is up first.
The likelihood was rising that Nagorno-Karabakh's 120,000 ethnic Armenians would flee the region, fearing persecution. That's after an Azerbaijan military victory last week in a conflict that dates back to the fall of the Soviet Union.
Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh continue to face the threat of ethnic cleansing. In recent days, humanitarian aid has arrived in Nagorno-Karabakh, but this does not change the situation. And unless real living conditions are created for the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh in their homes and effective mechanisms of protection from ethnic cleansing, then the likelihood that the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh will see exile from their homeland as the only way to preserve their lives and identity increases significantly.
A mass exodus could change the delicate balance of power in the South Caucasus region, a patchwork of ethnicities crisscrossed with oil and gas pipelines, where Russia, the United States, Turkey and Iran are jostling for influence. On Sunday, a Reuters reporter saw heavily laden cars with civilians approach an aid center in the Armenian border village of Kornizor. Last week, Azerbaijan scored a victory over ethnic Armenians who've controlled the Karabakh region since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. An advisor to the leader of the Karabakh Armenians told Reuters earlier on Sunday that the population would leave because they feel unsafe under Azerbaijani rule. Russia had acted as a guarantor for a peace deal that ended a 44-day war in Karabakh 3 years ago, and many Armenians blame Moscow for failing to protect the region. Indeed, Pashinyan blamed Russia publicly on Sunday for failing to do enough for Armenia, which he said would review its alliance with Moscow. Russian officials say Pashinyan is to blame for his own mishandling of the crisis.
That was Reuters reporter Edward Baran. French President Emmanuel Macron on Sunday said that France is immediately to withdraw its ambassador from Niger in the wake of the coup in the West African country that ousted the pro-Paris president. Macron added that military cooperation was over and French troops would withdraw in the months and weeks to come, with a full pullout by the end of the year. France keeps about 1,500 soldiers in Niger as part of an anti-insurgent deployment in the Sahel region. The development comes as U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin embarked on a journey to deepen bonds with U.S. allies across Africa. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with Austin and has more from his first stop in Djibouti.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Somali forces have made impressive progress in the fight against al-Shabaab.
They've made more progress in the last year than was made in the previous 5 years.
Austin met with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed in Djibouti on Sunday as part of his first visit to the African continent as defense secretary. Earlier, Austin met with the Djiboutian president and defense minister. He thanked them for hosting the United States' primary base in Africa, Camp Lemonnier, which has about 5,000 U.S. military personnel. Austin also told reporters Sunday that the Russian mercenary Wagner Group still has a substantial presence on the continent more than 1 month since the death of the group's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Austin heads to Kenya on Monday. It will be the first visit to Kenya by a U.S. defense secretary since 1976. He will round out his trip in Angola, the first time a U.S. defense secretary has ever visited the country. Carla Babb, VOA News, Djibouti.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. Six Portuguese children and young adults are set to take 32 European governments to court on Wednesday for what they say is a failure to adequately address human-caused climate change and a violation of their human rights. It's the first climate change case to be filed within the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. The World Health Organization says there is a global uptick in cholera cases. Said the number of cases reported last year was more than double of those reported in 2021. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that cholera can be a life-threatening disease that can spread through unsafe food or water. Cholera can also spread when human feces with cholera enter the water supply. A NASA space capsule carrying the largest soil sample ever scooped up from the surface of an asteroid streaked through Earth's atmosphere on Sunday and parachuted into the Utah desert. The U.S. government is less than 1 week away from a shutdown if the Republican-controlled House of Representatives can't coalesce around a dozen spending bills that have so far divided the party. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
In less than 1 week, the U.S. government will shut down if Congress can't come to agreements on spending bills that have so far exposed divisions within the Republican Party. A group of ultra-right-wing conservatives has threatened mutiny against and the ouster of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy following a spending compromise between him and President Joe Biden earlier this year to avoid defaulting on the nation's debt. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg speaking on ABC's This Week.
This is because Republicans can't even agree among themselves. And remember, Kevin McCarthy and Speaker McCarthy and President Biden made a deal. And that deal was tough for all sides. Frankly, it was tough for our department. It meant cutting back on some things we wanted to do, some funds we were going to use to improve roads and bridges and airports. But we accepted that because that was the deal that was made earlier this year. And now all we're doing is asking them to live up to that deal.
That same group of Republicans who are members of the controlling party in the House of Representatives wants deep cuts to domestic spending as well as to U.S. support for Ukraine in its ongoing war against invading Russia. President Biden last week welcomed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to the White House after the two spoke at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Biden pledged continued and unwavering support to Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden on U.S. Network Pool as provided by the Associated Press.
The people of Ukraine are steeled for this struggle ahead, and the United States is going to continue to stand with you.
McCarthy left $300 million of funding for Ukraine in an embattled defense spending bill before the House of Representatives. It's something unlikely to endear his far-right flank. Republican Representative Mike Turner speaking on ABC's This Week.
I'll bet on Kevin McCarthy any day, and we certainly have time yet to go. But he's in a very difficult position because the holdouts keep saying to Kevin McCarthy, don't bring bipartisan bills to the floor. We don't want you to use Democrat votes to try to avert a shutdown. But they're using Democrat votes to try to cause a shutdown. And these individuals, these Republican holdouts, are voting with Nancy Pelosi against Republican bills that have been brought to the floor.
McCarthy's party holds a slim majority in the House. Even as few as five Republican defectors are enough to derail any legislation the majority attempts to pass. Lawmakers who spent the weekend away from Washington returned Tuesday to try again to avert a government shutdown, which will happen at 12:01 a.m. October 1st if lawmakers fail to agree on even a short-term funding bill. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Philippines has accused China of blocking fishermen from a disputed area of the South China Sea by installing a floating barrier. Reuters' David Doyle has the details.
Footage released by the Philippine Coast Guard showed several Chinese vessels near the barrier, which Manila says is preventing Filipinos from entering and fishing in the area. A spokesperson said the Philippine Coast Guard and the Bureau of Fisheries and Aquatic Resources strongly condemn the installation of the barrier in part of the Scarborough Shoal. China claims 90% of the South China Sea, overlapping with the exclusive economic zones of Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Beijing seized the Scarborough Shoal in 2012, forcing Filipino fishermen to travel further for smaller catches. They were allowed to return as bilateral relations improved markedly under the Philippines' then-president, Rodrigo Duterte. But tensions have mounted again since his successor, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., took office last year. The Philippine Coast Guard and Fisheries Bureau personnel discovered the floating barrier on a routine patrol on Friday. China's embassy in Manila did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
David Doyle of Reuters News. New U.S. sanctions announced on Friday will target an additional group of Haitians linked to gang violence that has destabilized the crisis-plagued Caribbean nation. Sandra Lemaire explains.
In an exclusive interview with VOA Friday, Barbara Feinstein, the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Caribbean Affairs and Haiti, announced new sanctions targeting Haitians responsible for destabilization of the country.
Secretary Blinken today announced the designation of five more individuals for visa restrictions. And this is part of our broader policy of trying to promote accountability in Haiti for those individuals who are supporting gangs and destabilizing the situation.
In the meantime, in his speech before the UN General Assembly on Friday, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry repeated his urgent appeal for a multinational force to help Haiti's national police combat gang violence.
Le quotidien du peuple haïtien.
Haitian's daily life is painful. That is why the Security Council, which has the power and the authority, must act urgently under Chapter 7 to authorize the deployment of a multinational mission to reestablish security comprised of police and military personnel to help us combat the gangs and establish order.
While Henry was meeting with foreign leaders on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York to discuss Haiti's security crisis, powerful gang leader Jimmy Chourizier hit the streets of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, to put him on notice.
Today we are launching a battle against Ariel Henry. As we previously said, we are asking Haitians to mobilize, join us in the streets, because the real fight against Ariel Henry will be fought with guns.
Haiti's security situation and its appeal for a multinational force to help combat the gangs was a central theme at the UN General Assembly this week. President Joe Biden urged the Security Council to act quickly.
I call on the Security Council to authorize this mission now. The people of Haiti cannot wait much longer.
Kenya has expressed willingness to lead the force, which will be comprised of police officers as well as some military personnel.
Kenya is ready to play its part in full and join with a coalition of other nations of goodwill, and there are many, as a great friend and true sibling of Haiti.
But in Port-au-Prince, human rights activist Rosie Auguste expressed trepidation.
There have been several missions deployed to Haiti in the past. We believe they have always left a bitter taste in our mouths after departing.
Auguste cited the cholera epidemic, summary executions, child rape, and sex trafficking, which were prevalent during the UN peacekeeping mission to Haiti in 2004. Despite condemnation from human rights organizations, the abuses went largely unpunished. In New York, Feinstein told VOA U.S. officials are recognizant of the errors of the past.
I think we are personally invested in its success and also in learning the lessons from those prior missions.
The U.S. aims to present a resolution authorizing the Kenya-led mission in Haiti as early as next week. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Friday that the U.S. is providing Haiti with an additional $100 million in assistance for the Haitian National Police. Sandra Lemaire, VOA News.
In 2024, four countries are scheduled to have elections that could shape how the second half of this decade could progress. They're the United States, the European Parliament, India, and the Russian Federation. I recently discussed how what takes place in Moscow next year may impact the world stage with Adriano Bossoni, director of analysis at RAIN, a strategic intelligence company. What do you see as the overall importance of these elections in terms of driving policy, driving international relations, and driving the interactions that people have around the globe?
Yeah, we are talking about four of the largest economies in the world and four of the most impactful countries in the global arena. We are talking about, of course, the United States, the European Union, India, and Russia. We are talking about a population of roughly 2.3 billion people, a GDP of approximately $42 trillion. We are talking about countries that are willing to be active players on global affairs. And yes, it is a coincidence that the four of them are holding elections in 2024. And I want to be clear about this. We are a bit generous when we talk about Russia as an election, because we all know that it's not a proper election. And we know that Mr. Putin or someone he chooses will be elected with almost no real opposition. But it also fits the pattern of four big territories making leadership choices in 2024.
Taking a look at the 2024 elections in Russia, there's some concern whether or not they'll be free and fair, with either Russian President Vladimir Putin obtaining re-election or perhaps a designate winning the election in his stead. What do you see as the potential impact for that election having on the world stage?
Yeah, so as you said, this is not going to be a free or competitive election. Putin or somebody of his choice will win with little to no real opposition. But the interesting thing about what will happen next year is that the political process will be operating at a time when the social and economic impacts of the war in Ukraine are starting to be fully felt. There will be a big issue, which is whether or not Russia has to call for a widespread mobilization, as they need extra men to continue the war efforts in Ukraine. This would be an extraordinarily unpopular thing for Putin to do, even in the context of an autocracy with little to no real opposition. It would be very unpopular. So this will probably, almost certainly, I would say, not happen before the election, but the chances of mobilization happening after the election will increase, because there is no end in sight for the war in Ukraine. But perhaps more importantly for the future of global affairs, the election will not alter Moscow's assertive nationalism and its push to defend Russia's role as a global power. Quite the opposite. The election will have very strong nationalist, patriotic overtones, with a very strong message that we are fighting for the motherland and they are protecting ourselves against our many, many enemies around the world, which means that the chances of the Kremlin ending its invasion of Ukraine are extremely low. And so are the chances of a ceasefire with Ukraine, let alone a peace treaty, which we don't see in the foreseeable future.
That's the director of analysis at RAIN, Adriano Bossoni. And finally, with the economic pressures on local media creating so-called news deserts across the United States, student-led newspapers are filling the gap to ensure towns are kept informed. From Eudora, Kansas, Jessica Jarrett narrates this story by Liam Scott to round us out.
Eudora, Kansas. Population, 6,500. When the town's last newspaper shuttered during the recession, the residents were left without dedicated news coverage for about a decade. Then a media professor and her students from the University of Kansas stepped in. Terry Finneman is an associate journalism professor at the University of Kansas and publisher of the Eudora Times.
Somehow I found out that Eudora didn't have a newspaper, and I'm originally from a town of 2,500 people in western North Dakota. So to me, a town of 6,500 people is a large town. And so for a town this large to not have a newspaper, I thought it was just horrible.
Finneman and her students started small. Social media posts led to the Times' first article, the 2018 opening of Zeb's Coffee House on Main Street. The article jump-started local news coverage and a career for Lucy Crisman. Now a reporter for the Shawnee Mission Post, Crisman, as a student, wrote that first story and many others.
And it sort of ramped up from there when we realized what kind of potential there was to create like an honest-to-God newspaper here.
The Eudora Times has gone on to become an award-winning news outlet with a dual purpose, to provide students with reporting training and to bring local news back to this small town. The Times covers town government and events, high school sports and senior citizens, among other topics. And residents say they feel more involved in their community since the site launched. Kathy World is the owner of Zeb's Coffee House.
We love having the local voices heard. I think that it's really important to have an outlet for the things that are happening in our community for folks right here to know what's going on with their neighbors. It's just different than larger news sources.
Laura Smith helps direct residents to services as a community resource navigator.
Much more connected, much more in the loop, just as a community. I think they've really built our community.
The media outlet has worked to gain the community backing, especially at a time when distrust in media in the U.S. is at an all-time high. Again, Terry Finneman.
I want people face-to-face to see a reporter and know who they are and that they're a person and they're not just an enemy on the other end of the phone line.
For some students, covering this town led to careers in local news. Former Eudora Times features reporter Cami Coons now covers rural affairs for Kansas City PBS.
This is news that really matters. I don't need to work for the New York Times or a national publication to create news that makes a difference in people's lives.
At a time when the U.S. has lost more than one-fourth of its newspapers since 2005, the Eudora Times shows one possible solution to news deserts. For Liam Scott in Eudora, Kansas, Jessica Dreet, VOA News.
And until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Emerging technologies, including artificial intelligence or AI, will be instrumental and monumental in shaping the future of the world, carrying enormous potential for both good and evil. The military arena is one place where AI is surging. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said AI is central to our innovation agenda, helping us to compute faster, share better, and leverage other platforms. He pledged, however, that the approach of the United States toward the military uses of AI will be ethical and responsible, saying, "Responsible AI is the place where cutting-edge tech meets timeless values." Ethics and responsibility are the reasons why earlier this year, the United States unveiled the Political Declaration on Responsible Military Use of Artificial Intelligence and Autonomy. The declaration's aim is to build international consensus around how militaries can responsibly incorporate AI and autonomy into their operations while promoting respect for international law, security, and stability. Speaking on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Bonnie Jenkins, noted that the declaration acknowledges a shared challenge.
And what this is a document of a number of principles that we are hoping that countries will adopt that basically are things that they should consider and keep in mind as they use AI in the military.
The guidelines include subjecting systems to rigorous testing, taking steps to avoid unintended consequences, minimizing inadvertent biases, ensuring AI is used in accordance with country obligations under international law, and, as Undersecretary Jenkins emphasized, maintaining human control in decisions concerning the use of nuclear weapons.
There has to be a human involved in any kind of nuclear employment. And so we think that's really important that countries adopt and understand, even if they don't have nuclear weapons, you know, just the norm is important. And the more countries we can have adopt them, the better, and the more we can make it a real norm for all countries.
Undersecretary Jenkins noted that the principles of the declaration will be a topic of discussion at the October meeting of the UN's first committee, which deals with disarmament and international security issues. The United States looks forward to engaging with other stakeholders there on the crucial topic of how militaries will use AI in a responsible, ethical, and stabilizing manner.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.